Today's Teisho is on case 5 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record, or the Blue Rock Collection. Case 5 is entitled Seppos of a Grain of Rice. Engo's introduction: to guard and maintain the essential teachings of Buddhism must be the task of the noble soul. He does not blink when killing a man, and then the man may be instantly enlightened. Hence, he observes and acts simultaneously and holds fast and lets go without restraint. He sees that essence and phenomena are not two, that experience and reality run parallel. He often rejects the first principle and adopts the second. This is because to cut through the complications too abruptly causes the beginner to lose his footing. A day like yesterday, that could not have been avoided. Again, a day like today, his transgressions fill the heavens. If you are clear-sighted, however, you cannot blame him. If otherwise, put yourself in the tiger's mouth. You will lose your life instantly. Now, see the following. Main subject. Seppo addressed the assembly and said, "All the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face, but you do not see it. Beat the drum, telling the monks to come out to work, and search for it." Secho's verse: the ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. No dust on the mirror of the patriarch Soke. You beat the drum and search for it in vain. For whom do the spring flowers bloom? So, just a word. I want to thank everybody for sitting so well today. Everybody's sitting like a rock. It's just wonderful. First, a word just about Engo's introduction. In Zen literature, in Zen koans, there's a lot of what philosophers call antinomian discourse, right? So, Zen koan collections have these astonishing statements in them that are, shocking sometimes and even deeply disturbing. And this is one example of that. So it starts out by saying, to guard and maintain the essential teachings of Buddhism must be the vocation of the noble soul. He or she does not blink when killing a person, and then the person may be instantly enlightened. So, of course, if you follow Buddhism, you shouldn't kill anybody, But the language here is transgressive, right? It's really saying, don't be so concerned about doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. And sometimes Zen is really really maybe goes too far, dramatizing this. So a person is saying, to help somebody wake up, it's okay to kill him. So please don't take that literally, okay? But the point is that we can try to be good people, good people, and we can fail to be awakened people. It's not true that if you follow Zen, you shouldn't observe the precepts. So killing is number one, don't do, right? Stealing would be on that list, and so on. Please don't do those things. The precepts are really important. But on the other hand, you know, you can't always trust conventional morality or conventional values. That a lot of the time, you know, conventional values are not wise or not even good, right? Not even good. You know, and yesterday's conventional morality is today's immorality sometimes, right? And vice versa. So even though Zen, you know, sometimes in its statements, in its dramatic statements, goes a little too far, you know, I think there's a real real lesson here for us. You know, this idea that, you know, it's possible to be a good person and not be a wise person. It's possible to be a good person and not be an awakened person. So anyway, just please keep that in the back of your mind somewhere. When I was when I was a little kid, you know, nothing made me happier than when I was really little, not when I was a teenager. When I was a teenager, nothing made me happier than upsetting my parents. But when I was a little kid, nothing made me happier than pleasing my parents. You know, so I think I wasn't alone in this. I think like lots of little kids, I got a lot of pleasure out of seeing a warm look of affirmation in my parents' eyes, you know. And on the other hand, you know, what would make me less happy was like a look of disapproval, like a look of disapproval. I would say my mother was a pretty good mother. When I look back on my mother, I have really wonderful feelings about her. You know, she was, I think, a very loving person. And, you know, she would spend hours on, you know, taking care of me, my brother, and my sister, and not just feeding us and clothing us, but sort of cultivating our interest in things. You know, my mother used to read to us. We were really little, like, you know, five. My brother would have been four. My sister wasn't born yet. And my mother would just spend like an afternoon reading like Bambi, right? She read Bambi to us. And, you know, at some point we'd be crying, you know, it was so moving. I can't really remember my mother's voice very well, but I know that, you know, my mother reading these books to me, her voice was just so wonderful to hear. And, you know, sometimes she would ask me, she would ask me, what did I think of a book that she read? And I didn't want to say, oh, I didn't like it. You know, I didn't like that one. Because it's like a little bit of light would go out of her eyes, you know. And it wasn't anger. It was just like disappointment, right? She'd want to share something with me and my brother that she loved, and she'd read us something. And so, you know, sometimes I would just fake it. I'd say, oh, you know, look at her with bright eyes and say, oh, I loved that story. And I think this is a good thing, not a bad thing. I think I was being generous, right, in a certain way, but I also wanted to make my mother happy. I wanted to please my mother, right? And this is a normal human behavior. And my mother was somebody I was happy to please until I was about 12, and then I no longer was interested in pleasing her, and I drove her crazy. My father was more complicated because my father was not necessarily always a loving person. He had, you know, you would say anger issues, and he was much more strict with us. You know, he wasn't kindly, you know, he was strict. So, you know, in the case of responding to him, we wanted to be liked by him, but for like a different reason, right? It was like we respected him, and a little bit I feared my father. And And I wanted to be liked by him because, you know, I thought he was like somebody I should be liked by, if that makes any sense. You know, in other words, my father was like an authority figure. And I thought it was important to be liked by authority, an authority figure like my father. And, you know, when my father would get mad, it was frightening, right? So I definitely didn't want to have that happen. So, you know, sometimes when I was responding to other people, I was genuine. And sometimes when I was responding to people, I was doing it out of love, really. When I was responding falsely to people, I was doing it out of love. And sometimes I was doing it out of fear. Right? You know, and as you grow up, you know, this dynamic continues. You know, and it moves beyond your parents. At some point, to be seen in the eyes of your parents is not necessarily important anymore for a certain period of time, and then hopefully it is again. But when I was about 12 years old, it was suddenly as though I didn't care what my parents thought. The people who really mattered to me were like the people. Were like my age peers, right? So I was all of a sudden very interested in my appearance, which is something when I was young, I didn't know how I looked, and I didn't even think about it. But when I began to be about 12 or 13, I became very interested in my appearance. I became very worried that other people didn't see me, my age peers, right, didn't see me as a cool person, as a person worthy of admiration or respect. And, you know, that was when I would start to argue with my mother when we would go buying clothes in the fall. Because, you know, my mother wanted me to wear these clothes that she thought of as like good clothes. And I wanted to wear the clothes that were like, you know, this was about the time the Beatles were, you know, so I wanted to, if I had had my wish, I would have had my hair cut like, the Beatles with my bangs cut in the front, and I would have worn these tight-fitting pants with white socks and black shoes, but that was impossible. But, you know, there was all this, popular culture, and you know, I felt totally outside the orbit of my friends at school. I felt, you know, unfashionable. I felt monstrous, you know, and I wanted to be admired by them. And I worked so hard to have them see, to get that look of approval from them. You know, it was really important. There were certain guys, mostly there were guys, that I thought of in my circle, in the kids, actually on this military base where we were stationed, who I thought were like the cool people, right? And I actually thought in my mind, he's cool, you know. And there was a guy named Wayne, and he was cool. He actually dressed like a Beatle, you know. His older brother was a musician, like with an electric guitar. So just being close to Wayne gave me the feeling I was on the right path. There was a guy named Mark Miller, also very cool. You know, Mark Miller's older brother was said to be already sexually active. And he was a very handsome guy. And Mark was not quite as handsome, but fairly handsome, and they all had sort of, they had long hair, like hip haircuts, and they always had like nice clothes. Wayne used to come with these tight black pants and a paisley shirt, which was just open at the throat, you know, and no buttons on the collar, and it was just, he looked like he was about to, he had just landed from California or something. And Mark was also like very cool and had these mannerisms that I noticed, you know, I so wanted them to like me. And I cultivated their friendship and sort of got into their circle. Right? Sort of got into their circle. It was so important. And, you know, and if I felt that I was, like, slipping out of their circle, I was really worried. I thought, what do I have to do to stay in this circle? I didn't, you know, consciously think this out, but I see in retrospect how much of my behavior was coming from this place where I felt really unlovable or unlikable, and how I thought these were the popular people, popular kids at school, and I really wanted to be a popular kid, right? And you know, it was kind of a hopeless enterprise, right? But it was so much what I wanted, and it caused me a lot of anguish. I used to be pretty chubby kid, so I really stopped eating. You know, I lost a lot of weight. I would just eat like dinner, and that was it. You know, and because I wanted to be thin like my friends, and I began to steal cigarettes from my parents, who were both like fatal chain smokers. You know, my father died of lung cancer when he was 68. So, you know, I stole cigarettes from my parents, and I would take them to school. And, you know, during the rec period, we would go out behind the school and sneak a cigarette, right? It was just so, I felt so, cigarettes made me want to throw up, but I felt like I was now becoming somebody worthy of attention. I don't think I'm unusual in this regard. I was so hungry for approval from these people. You know, all of this fell apart, you know, for various reasons. At some point, I just gave up on the. I sort of drifted away from these people. I realized I was never going to fit into their circle. I just didn't have what it took. And around this time, I began to get interested in, like, reading in school. And my brother went out for, my brother was like very handsome guy. And the women, young women, really liked my brother a lot because he was very handsome. And he was athletic, right? My brother ran track. He was like super athletic. And he could really win, you know, it was amazing. He was shorter than I am, and he had like very nice shoulders and very, very nice physique. And he was very athletic, very popular. Like he had friends, you know, coming out as Wazoo. So, you know, I realized I actually did some sports. I was on a swim team and a track team, but I wasn't like a track star or a swimming team star. You know, I did it mostly just because I wanted to do sports, but I was not very good. And I realized I could be a good scholar, right? I realized that I could get great, you know, good grades. And, you know, part of the reason I worked so hard at school was that I enjoyed learning things, but really that was a secondary motivation. I really enjoyed being approved of by my teachers. You know, I really felt great to excel at something and have people look at me and say, you matter, you know, you really matter. And it made me want to, you know, it made me want to do really well in school. Just getting, you know, every year the school would give out little trophies for academic achievement. And I would get a trophy, like, you know, there are a number of people would get trophies. It wasn't just one. It was a number of people, I'd get a trophy every year, you know. I took a history, world history course in, I think it was the eighth grade, and the professor would give a quiz every time or every other class, and we'd have to, he'd give us the quiz, and we were supposed to exchange our papers. And then we would grade the papers. He had a system where he didn't have to do any work. I didn't realize this at the time, but exchange papers. Now, then he'd give us the answers, and we'd correct the papers. And then he'd take his grade book out, and he'd say, read the grade. So, you know, if somebody graded Spellmeyer's paper, he'd read the grade. And, you know, I worked so hard. I would stay up late at night. You know, I always got like a 95, 100. And, you know, people were getting 30s, you know. And it made me feel so real. It made me feel like this. Now I'm becoming a person, you know. So I think my experience in this regard is similar to other people's, I would guess. You know, where, you know, as we're growing up, we play to our strengths, right? We like people to acknowledge us, and but you know, in a certain way, this is actually like really unhealthy behavior, right? You know, the fact is that the more we are trying to be noticed by others, you know, we want to be noticed by others. Because we feel unconnected to them, right? We want to be noticed by others because we feel unconnected. And when we, you know, like try to be noticed by them and seek their approval, we think we're getting closer to them. But that's really often not how it works. It actually often creates deeper sense of isolation. Deeper sense of isolation. You know, that I think that's something that people don't necessarily appreciate. You know, to be real, you know, we try to get other people to approve of us and to get that look in their eye, like you matter, you're important. And that makes us feel connected, but actually we may be becoming more and more trapped. More and more trapped. I hope this is making some sense. You know, when I started doing well in school, in high school, I would get like A's on almost everything. And my motivation wasn't love of learning. You know, increasingly it was just to be the A student. And when I would come home, my parents would go, oh, an A student, you know, oh. And so on. They would talk to their friends and say, oh, honor roll again, you know. And so, but you know, I remember sometimes I would fall down, right? Like, so I wouldn't get an A on a paper. I'd get like a B plus. And, you know, when I would come home that weekend, my whole weekend was like ruined, right? Ruined. Because, you know, I was supposed to be the A person, and I didn't, you know, cut myself or burn myself, fortunately, you know. I didn't know about doing those things. But I just felt rotten all weekend. You know, I think I was sort of like emotionally punishing myself for not being the person I thought I was supposed to be. You know, and I've actually seen this behavior in, like, other settings, too, like a sports, you know. A lot of people in the sports world are actually, you know, get into these very self-destructive behaviors. And I think it's the same sort of dynamic, right? It's like the more we want the approval from others, strangely, the more, it feels like connection, but it's actually isolating us more and more like in this, it's a false connection. It's a false connection. It's like, look at me, you know, I'll be the person you want me to be. I'll be the person you want me to be. Just look at me. And when they look at you and you're like, you know, selling yourself, like, please, you know, like me, you know. This is so human. This is actually so human. We all have done it, or we all do it, right? But you know, the irony is that it's not getting us where we want to go. You know, I have to say that I kind of became a prisoner of my desire to be a good student. You know, I remember studying with this guy when I was in graduate school, who was really a very famous literary scholar. And he was talking about growing up in Brooklyn, and I said, "And I assume you were an A student." And he went, "A student? No way. You know, I barely passed the 10th grade, you know?" And I was like, "What? You know, you barely passed the 10th grade." And I couldn't really, compute that idea. But, you know, he was busy with other things. It was like he was interested in baseball, you know? For him, it was, who cares about school? Baseball. And I think that in some ways that was so good for him, right? You know, he was not so concerned with the way other people thought of him, right? He was more engaged in life in a kind of, he was more engaged in life in a different way. He wasn't searching for gratification, which is something we all search for. You know, he was a big baseball fan, and he was one of these, you know, a few years ago, before COVID, I used to go to a gym in the morning. I'd get up at 5 and sit, and then if I didn't have to teach, I'd go to the gym. And at the gym, one of the guys who used to work out next to me was the city manager for the city of Watchung, New Jersey. He's a great guy. But he's like one of these baseball, one of these baseball aficionados who knows everything. And there was another guy who was in IT, who was about my age. And the city manager, Tom, was about my age. And they grew up in that baseball culture. And they would just sit there and go, "Do you remember when Rodriguez did blah, blah, blah?" And he'd go, "Oh, of course. You know, it was July 12th. You know, it wasn't quite like that. But they knew, it was like this knowledge of baseball, right? You know, that was incredible. He said, "Did you remember the World Series in such and such? And it was at Boston." "No, no, it was an away game. It was at Cincinnati." And they remembered all this stuff, and they knew all the scores. Well, you know, one of my mentors in graduate school was like this. He had, you know, baseball was his passion until he got to college, right? And you know, he lived basically, he played baseball, but he knew he would never be a pro ball player. But, you know, and I have to admit, there's something about, if you like baseball, you know, there's something majestic about it, right? You go out to the field, ball field, so beautiful in the morning, right? Games are played mostly at night, but if you've ever been to a ball field in the morning, it's so pristine and green. This was before AstroTurf, right? And they used to have, sprinklers watering the grass. And baseball, you know, it's sort of lost its appeal for a lot of people, but it's really a majestic game. It's really a beautiful game. You know, the bases are loaded, and somebody hits a, you know, it's so hard to hit a ball with a stick, right? And you knock the ball out of the park. It's like, oh my God, that's astounding, right? And in the nick of time. So there's a kind of, you go to a ball game and when I was a kid, you go to a ball game and there's 30,000 people there, right? Or 20,000 people there. And, you know, they're all sweating and crying and sitting on the edge of their seats at the same time. It's such a beautiful bonding experience, right? You know, it's just like everybody in the state, you know, 10,000 people are holding their breath at the same time, you know, and half of them are going to be crying and half of them are going to be ecstatic at the end of the game. You know, that's a kind of powerful bond, right? And, you know, you're just a guy in the stadium, or you're just a woman in the stadium. Nobody knows you. Nobody's looking at you. But this sense of connection is so deep. It's so deep. And I think it's really really powerful, and it's very different from that, you know, the sense of connection we're seeking when we're trying to get other people to approve of us, you know? It's like, you know, it's like the more I'm trying to get other people to like me, the more isolated I'm becoming, yeah? And, you know, if I get their approval for something, you know, I become sort of like a prisoner of their approval, you know, the prisoner of their approval. And I think everybody, you don't have to look far to see this behavior where people become prisoners of their, you know, like psychological dependence on the approval of others. It, you know, in Zen, there's a story about Bodhidharma. If you know this, you've probably heard this story before. But Bodhidharma is the monk from India who brought Zen to China. And when Bodhidharma came to China, he had a reputation in India as a great meditation master. And he was introduced to this person whose name was Wu of Liang. Wu of Liang. He was a small, like, small kingdom. He's like the king of Liang, basically. Called an emperor, but he was really a king. And he was a genuinely good person. He funded all of these temples and convents and built libraries and so on and so on. And he had many, he had met many distinguished monks and nuns from India and promoted their teaching in his country. And he was like a wonderful guy. Bodhidharma, when he arrived at that area, he had an interview with the emperor. And, you know, basically, if this had gone well, Emperor Wu would have said, well, Bante or Hirshang, you know, I will fund your temple. You know, I'll build a temple for you, and you can teach Zen, and some people will come from all over China to study with you, and I'll endow your temple, you know, there'll be scholarships. But they didn't hit it off at all, right? Zen begins with a failed job interview, basically, in China. And Bodhidharma is utterly genuine, right? He's just the person he is. And Emperor Wu of Liang is actually genuine too, and they just don't hit it off. And the emperor says, tell me about holiness. And Bodhidharma says, in Zen, we don't believe in holiness. We believe in vast emptiness. And then the emperor didn't get it, and interview was over. Bodhidharma went up into the mountains, right? And there he just sat in a cave for 9 years until students showed up. In other words, he didn't do anything to like build up a following or anything of the kind. He just waited for causes and conditions to be correct, be right. And one day, lo and behold, this person comes out to the cave where Bodhidharma's living, and says, I want to be your student. And it's winter, and the snow is deep, and Bodhidharma's in the cave, and this young scholar, he's actually like somebody who's very knowledgeable, very learned person, has reached kind of despair because his knowledge is not liberating to him. He's got a knowledge of the Confucian classics, the Book of Odes, and he's totally unhappy, and he hears about this Indian monk, so he goes up into the mountains and finds him. And he's outside the cave, and he says, I'd like to be your student. And Bodhidharma's been practicing Zen by himself for 9 years, and instead of saying, yes, thank God you're here, he says, oh, I don't know. I'll think about it. So this this young man who's called, in Japanese, he's called Shinko. Shinko is so determined that he sits in the snow all night, and in the koan, not in reality, he says he cuts off his arm. And when Bodhidharma sees him, he offers him his arm. So, you know, please don't do this at home. Don't cut off your arm. But what Bodhidharma says is not, oh, now I see you're really serious. In the story, he says, you didn't have to cut off your arm. He said, you didn't have to do that. He said, I'm just looking for a person who does, I'm just trying to find a person who doesn't look to others for approval. You know, now that can easily be misunderstood. You know, you could be thinking, well, no, you know, a heroic person just follows, does what he wants, you know. But that's not really what Bodhidharma meant by saying that. You know, the problem with seeking the approval of others isn't that you're not thinking for yourself, or you're not, you know, your own boss. The problem is that you're not discovering the proper way of interacting with other people. The correct motivation, right? The correct motivation. So basically, you know, when I was a teenager and I wanted everybody to like me, and I was constantly working the system, getting them to notice me and getting them to like me, I was a prisoner of that dynamic. And I was very far from a genuine relationship with any of them, right? Any of them. You know, this koan is really about this very thing, right? Senpo addressed the assembly and said, all the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. Okay, so if I throw it in your face, you don't even see it. So, you know, if you think about the fact that there are about something like 8 billion people on Earth, you know, every time you begin to feel like you're unique, you know, it's worth remembering there's 8 billion people on Earth, way too many, really, for the planet. And there may soon be 10 billion people. And when you think about something like that, it can be so terrifying, right? I mean, one of the things we like to imagine is that or at least one of the things I like to imagine sometimes, is that I'm in control of my life, right? And, you know, all of us want to make a difference. All of us want to make, you know, I'm an English teacher, so when I go into a classroom, I take it really seriously. You know, I want to be a good teacher. I want my students to say, wow, this was an incredible English class. You know, it's changed the way I think. And I love that. You know, I feel like now I'm making a difference. You know? But when you think, oh, there's 10 billion people, how can anybody make a difference? Really? You know, that's just, you're smaller and smaller. When you think of all the people, you get smaller and smaller and smaller, and it can begin to give you this terrible sense of isolation, right? This terrible sense of powerlessness and isolation and separateness, right? And you know, that sense of isolation and separateness is what drives a lot of human behavior, you know, wanting to look like the Beatles, you know, wanting to dress like a rock star, et cetera, right? You know, it's normal human behavior, but it's coming out of this terror of being unimportant or being just nothing, being nothing. You say, oh, I'm nothing. So the koan's really asking us to work with that. It's really asking us to work with that. And, you know, if people don't necessarily like this koan, they don't necessarily want to think about a grain of rice, right? And they, in particular, they don't want to identify with the grain of rice, you know. So often in koans, there's something that the student working on the koan doesn't want to see, you know, doesn't. For me, I definitely didn't want to be this grain of rice. Who the hell wants to be a little grain of rice, you know? So this koan took me a long time. When I was training with Genki Roshi, initially, I was sure that, you know, I was going to make rapid progress, and I was just sure, you know, I felt that there was something special about my Zen practice, and that my teacher would see it. At the same time, you know, I couldn't answer my koans, right? And so, Genki Roshi arrived from Ryutakuchi in Japan, I think in 1977. And Webb Roshi brought him there to be the teacher at the Seattle Zen Center. And Genki had quite a good, Genki Roshi had quite a good reputation. And, you know, his arrival was much anticipated. And when he got there, you know, there were a lot of students. This was the 1970s. There was very much of a, Seattle was like a counterculture hippie town. So, you know, this Zen master is coming here, you know, like, I think we had 50 people on our first session, something like that. And, you know, so Genki Roshi had, like, immediately this very large number of students, and he gave us all, you know, our breath perception koan, right? So watch the breath. Please watch the breath. And then we started doing sashin. We started sitting every morning and there was sitting in the morning and evening. Not everybody went to all the sits, but some people did. And then there was sashin. And, you know, I at first had, you know, stuck my toe in the water, but I began to be really engaged by this. And I would go to sashin, and, you know, I could not answer the breath per se. You know, I didn't know what to do with this koan. And I would come into Dokusan, and I'd have all these answers, and Genki Roshi would just ring the bells like, no, 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 no. And all these other people would, you know, we'd be in the Dokusan, in that system, we all sat in a separate line, the Dokusan line. And even though you're never supposed to talk about your koan practice with other people, you know, people would come out of the Dokusan line with a big smile on their face. And after the sesshin, you know, I'd be driving home with my friends and people would say, oh, yeah, I passed that koan. Now he gave me a new koan, but what did he give you? And, you know, you're not supposed to be talking about it, but people would talk. And I would be quiet because I hadn't answered my koan. I hadn't answered the very first koan. So, you know, I really wanted Genki Roshi to look at me and see me and say, you know, you are a special person. And I so wanted that because I wasn't getting it in other areas of my life. And, you know, then I kept going into Dokusan and he kept saying, no, that's not it. No, 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 no. And all these, you go home, and all these other people would sit me saying, yeah, I passed this koan, I passed this. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to be 80 years old and I won't have passed the first koan. I'll be a, you know, famous Zen failure. So anyway, at one point, Genki Roshi, the way we do our food is different from the way the Seattle Zen Center did it. Genki Roshi would appoint somebody to be the cook for 6 months, basically. So that person would do two sashins and would be in charge of like most of the cooking. So instead of having like a team of people in the kitchen the way we do and rotating, one person would just do all the cooking for all the meals with some helpers. So it was a different experience. It was a big job, and that meant, you know, basically you were in the kitchen most of the time, or you were at the grocery store, right? And you got very little sitting time in. You know, you'd sit in the morning and then a little bit, and then you had to go get breakfast ready, and then you could sit in the afternoon, but then you had to get, you know, so basically what you were doing was you were giving up two sesshins in order to be the cook, because the teacher asked you to be the cook. And, you know, some people definitely shouldn't have been the cook. You know, some of the food was really, really terrible. It's just unbelievable. You know, people, guys mostly, who had never cooked, you know, were just absolutely, some of the meals I remember as being horrifying, right? Or just boring, right? Rice, miso soup, and some vegetables. Rice, miso soup. So Genki Roshi, he asked me, and I was so disappointed. I thought, you know, please not now. I feel like I'm just about to answer my koan. Not now, you know, later. But he said, no, I want you to do this now. And so I was so bummed out. Anyway, you know, I didn't have any plan, you know. I just started being the cook. And I had worked in the food industry. After I got out of college, for a couple of years, I worked in restaurants before I went to graduate school. I worked in an Italian restaurant in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I met my wife. It was called Mamma Mia's. And I learned a lot about cooking Italian food. And I worked at another restaurant in the Washington, D.C. area, French restaurant. And, you know, I learned how to make sauces and breads, you know, and I educated myself a lot. So I'm actually a pretty good cook. So anyway, you know, I just started cooking. And I did things like, you know, I didn't necessarily confine myself to, like, Asian cuisine, right? I made bread. I made, like, rye bread, you know? And one time I made a vegetarian dish with a Bernaise sauce, a vegetarian Bernaise sauce. And you know, I got into it. You know, I don't know, I wasn't trying to achieve anything. But I began to have, I had not had the pleasure of cooking for other people and seeing how happy it made them, right? But that's what I did. You know, I got into this, and I would actually, like, they'd serve the food, and I'd look through the glass window, and I'd see everybody eating a lot. And at the end of the evening, there was, like, nothing left, and I'd made a lot. So it's like people were enjoying the food, right? And I would make, at the end of the evening, like before people would go to bed, I would make some little rolls. All the rolls would be gone. People would take them and eat. It gave me so much pleasure, right? So much pleasure to do this. And it was unlike, I'm ashamed to say that in my life I had very few relationships with people based upon that kind of interaction. Where, you know, basically I wasn't trying to get their approval, I was trying to make them happy, you know? Because I was a reasonably selfish and self-absorbed person, right? Maybe exceptionally so. But doing this was so wonderful, right? I just totally got into it. And I threw myself into this, and I think the food was fantastic. And I was totally exhausted. On the way home, we were driving home, and my friends, Sybil McCappia and Glenn Hirschman, I was driving home with them. And they said, I was so tired that I was saying something, and they said, you stopped in mid-sentence and fell asleep. But at the end of the session, you know, at the end of the session, Genki Roshi, somebody came to the kitchen and said, Genki Roshi wants to see you. And I went in to see Genki Roshi, and he said, I have never seen you do something for others before. You know, he said, you know, basically, this is something I'm so happy to see. And he said, you haven't really passed the breath koan, but I'm going to pass you anyway. Right? Because what you have done is, like, what you've shown me is like bodhisattva spirit. Bodhisattva spirit. And he said, so, you know, you're doing something right. You're not passing your koan, but something is going on that's good, basically. And, you know, that was one of the best moments of my life, right? That was just like the first, like, little glimpse of light coming into my life. So that's what this koan is all about. So it's not so important to be approved of by others, right? Not even to be thought of like as a good person. You know, that's not necessarily the important thing. Now, you know, feeding others is something else again, right? To guard and maintain the essential teachings of Buddhism must be the vocation of the noble soul. He does not blink when killing a man, and then the man may be instantly enlightened. Hence, he observes and acts simultaneously, and holds fast and lets go without restraint. See, the motivation isn't approval. It's what has to be done to feed others. He sees that essence and phenomena are not two, that experience and reality run parallel. He often rejects the first principle and adopts the second. This is because to cut through the complication too abruptly causes the beginner to lose his footing. So, you know, a good Zen teacher doesn't say everything all at once, right? He says, just watch your breath. You know, that's good enough for now. A day like yesterday, that could not be avoided. Again, a day like today, his transgressions fill the heavens. So in other words, he's constantly unconcerned about the expectations of others. She's constantly unconcerned about the expectations of others. She's always concerned with taking care of others. Again, if you are clear-sighted, however, you cannot blame him for breaking the rules. If, however, you put yourself in the tiger's mouth, you will lose your life instantly. Now see the following. Seppo addressed the assembly and said, all the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. Nobody wants to be a grain of rice, but try it. Just try it. I throw it in front of your face, but you do not see it. Beat the drum, telling the monks to come out to work and search for it. Secho's verse, the ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. No dust on the mirror of the patriarch Soke. You beat the drum and search for it in vain. For whom do the spring flowers bloom?